Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The last five decades have seen the dramatic globalization of organized crime and corruption, now totaling trillions of dollars every year, according to the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project. With the help of a criminal services industry, corrupt banks, law firms, registration agents, and lobbyists, criminal networks have steadily grown their markets, and the world's most corrupt officials and tycoons easily loot, launder, and hide stolen money for future use. The result is an unprecedented transfer of wealth and global web of high-level corruption and organized crime that is fueling global inequality. It's also resulting in the rise of extremist groups and the decline of democratic institutions all over the world. Paul Radu and Drew Sullivan, the co-founders of the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project, believe that if people have the information about these organized crime networks, they can change the system. OCCRP works with a network of more than 55 small nonprofit media centers around the globe, and they have published so many incredible and important investigations. One, the Pandora Papers. We did a number of shows about this. It was a massive leak of confidential financial documents comprising nearly 12 million files from 14 companies. The story exposes how several countries' government officials use offshore bank accounts and property holdings to hide hundreds of billions of dollars worth of proceeds from corrupt activities. These countries include Russia, Serbia, and Ukraine, to name a few. Western lawyers, accountants, lobbyists, they make it possible for this global illicit money to flow. The West is a major enabler of this global crime and corruption, according to the project's investigations. Joining us today are Paul Radu and Drew Sullivan. Paul Radu is co-founder of the OCCRP, co-creator of the project's investigative dashboard, which helps journalists trace people, companies, and assets across the globe, co-founder of the RISE Project, a platform for investigative reporters in Romania, and contributor to many handbooks and digital guides, including Follow the Money, a digital guide to tracking corruption. Hi, Paul. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Drew Sullivan is co-founder and publisher of the OCCRP and creator of Reporters Shield, a membership program that helps defend investigative journalism against legal harassment. Hi, Drew. Thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be here, Rose.
Great to have you. Paul Radu and Drew Sullivan will be speaking about how to get dirty and dark money out of democracy tonight at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco at 6 p.m. You can find ticket information at yourcallradio.org. Tomorrow, they'll be in discussion following a screening of The Killing of a Journalist. This is a documentary that we will be discussing today. The film was produced by the OCCRP. That event starts at noon in the Ensenia Hall at Stanford University. Find more information at yourcallradio.org. Well, thank you both so much for joining us. We've done so many shows about some of the investigations that you all published, very powerful investigations. And Paul, I was watching a video in which you and Drew were speaking about the work you do. And Paul, you said that your problem is not fake news. Your problem is that there is not enough real, truthful news out there. So can you begin by talking more about that?
Absolutely. I mean, fake news is a huge problem. I mean, there's no doubt about that. But the real issue here is that we don't have enough investigative power in the world. And this is what we're trying to change with OCCRP. When I'm saying this, I'm referring to the fact that even, I mean, by a gross estimate, let's say, and the gross exaggeration, there's not more than, let's say, 10,000 investigative reporters in the world. Out of these 10,000, which is maybe a large village, you know, very few are actually specialized in following the money across borders. So what you have here is a huge imbalance between the investigative reporting firepower, let's say, and the criminals on the other side who have built their networks over many decades and who have amassed a lot of power and money. So investigative reporters started networking about, let's say, 15 years ago in a meaningful way. And criminals started about 5 decades ago. So this disparity right there, you know, tells us that criminals are much more ahead of journalists when it comes to their crime and to creating these networks that, you know, loot people, loot citizens of many countries around the world and affect the interests of citizens, including here in the U.S., but really all over the world, while journalists are playing a little bit of a catch-up game. So this is why we do need to increase this investigative power, and this is what we're trying to do at OCCRP, because we see ourselves as an engine that powers the investigative reporting of the world, and we want to have OCCRP contribute to really creating meaningful citizen investigative reporting somewhere down the line.
Wow, it is so interesting to learn that there are about 10,000 investigative reporters around the globe. And the work that they're doing is so important to expose this because, Drew, you say that corruption and crime account for about 20% of the global economy. You say it is one of the most destructive things on Earth. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah. So really, what people don't realize is that so much in the world is corrupt. You know, the world is far more corrupt than we really understand. And whole country economies are corrupt. You know, they're based on smuggling and other systems. And so you have a lot of money that just naturally kind of courses through these illegal systems, money laundering systems and corrupt banks and through offshore companies, which is really the biggest problem. And so, you know, when you have that, it kind of empowers these illegal systems. And then, of course, these illegal systems are used by, you know, major crime gangs and by state actors and by, you know, corrupt businesses and others. And then that really exacerbates the system, you know. So, you know, if you've got that much illegal money and so much of this money is from profoundly undemocratic states, that money acts, you know, non-democratically. And that's what really causes the problems, you know. So often when it's in the hands of, you know, wealthy state actors. And what's happened is there's really been almost an alternative economy that has really grown across the world of people willing to, you know, launder money and willing to behave in a legal manner. And there is pressure by this new economy to really you know, not be looked at. So you have all sorts of systems from hedge funds in the United States, which are essentially unregulated. And then you've got, you know, banks, which are regulated, but still continue on to deal with this illegal money because it's very profitable for them. So they simply continue to deal with it. And then when they get fined, they pay a large fine, and then they continue to deal with it again. And all of this erodes the ability to really track the money and to really see where dark money, you know, where money that's actually meant to be harmful is coming into the system. And it is into extremist groups and into propaganda channels and other places. And that's where you really undermine democracy.
And we're talking about trillions of dollars every year.
Well, the illegal, you know, illegal businesses are due about, you know, crime is about $2 trillion, maybe even as high as $3 trillion a year. And so all that money has to go someplace, and it goes into, you know, into high end apartments in New York. And, you know, the placing of the money, you know, in the system, it has to end up somewhere. So, there's actually far more money in the hands of organized crime than people realize. And over the years, there's now trillions of dollars. And if you look at the rise of kind of, globalization of crime, and if you look at the unlocking of the money in Russia and other countries that happened with the fall of the Berlin Wall, it almost exactly tracks the growth of the stock market in the United States during the 2000s. It tracks the growth of hedge funds. And so a significant, chunk of that money is now in legitimate systems. And of course, you know, that's the money that's funding extremist groups and political parties and giving contributions to the most extreme, you know, left or right, you know, political interests. And that's what's really – and that money wants to undermine law enforcement. It wants to undermine, you know, rule of law, and it wants to undermine democracy. And so it's really become a problem. In a lot of ways, you know, we thought in the 90s when the Berlin Wall fell that we were going to change Russia by making it, you know, a capitalist country that would, you know, tend towards democracy. And really what happened is Russia changed us more. They you know, this global system of corruption has really been on the ascendancy for some time.
Hmm. We'll talk about some of the investigations that focus on what is happening in Russia and the money coming out of Russia. You just published the Rotenberg files, a massive investigation. You can find a link at yourcallradio.org. Since you brought up law enforcement, Drew, I wanted to talk about this for a minute because I think this is really important. Paul, you say that we're talking here about drug trafficking, the trafficking of women and children, forced labor, money laundering. You say law enforcement agencies should be cracking down on this, but they cannot go across borders to investigate this organized crime. There is no global organized crime unit. So what we have left to expose this is investigative reporters who can go across borders. Can you talk more about that?
Absolutely. I mean, really, law enforcement was not designed for this type of global threats. Law enforcement is always paid with taxpayers' money, with local taxpayers' money. They're designed, you know, to protect the people in the police, in the city state. And there's no real meaningful cooperation across borders between law enforcement agencies to be able to tackle an enemy such as organized crime that's you know, transnational in nature. So we're seeing very often large drug trafficking cases that spill into, you know, corrupting politicians, you know, with the money that's generated by that drug trafficking and so on, going from continent to continent with a sense of impunity. Because even if a local law enforcement does something against the network, they will tackle the network in a very limited way, and that allows the rest of the network to grow and to flourish. It got to the level where we're seeing networks that are operating in the 1980s, right? In the past century, basically. And these networks are still at it, except that the people who started these networks gained so much money and so much power that they are now what we call criminal angel investors. They are really people investing in more crime because that's very lucrative for them, because the return on investment is huge for them. So You're seeing these old-timers, old criminals, who are really, you know, big in the 80s, sponsoring new waves of crime and corruption, sponsoring younger criminals. And this is something that law enforcement cannot really match. First of all, because they stop at the borders of a nation state. That's the first thing. And the second thing is the criminals always think longer term. They are very, very early technology adopters. So they have many tools, you know, many things compared to law enforcement. So this is why the only people really out there who are able to expose some of what is going on, but not all, are the investigative reporters through our networking and through the tools that we're creating. But as I said before, this is a very uneven fight because we don't have the resources, we don't have the people, and we don't have you know, the abilities that the criminals have, because the criminals can co-opt what we call the enablers, this criminal services industry, you know, scores armies of lawyers, accountants, bankers, who unfortunately work for them. And, you know, journalists have had to scrap together, you know, their networks and try to embed as much technology and be smart about it. And I'm very proud of our work. But I think there's so much to be done, you know, and we need to increase the space and to allow others to become investigators, to really become a force against these organized crime forces.
Drew, can you tell us more about the journalists you work with? You work with a network of more than 55 small nonprofit media centers around the globe. And in many cases, these journalists are really putting their lives on the line to expose this information. You've got a podcast called Dirty Deeds, Tales of Global Crime and Corruption. And every other week, This podcast focuses on the OCCRP's most important investigations, showcasing the work of this worldwide network of journalists who cross borders to shine a light on these dangerous criminal networks. So can you tell us how, what it takes to really cross borders to expose this work? And then in many cases, journalists have been threatened. I mean, that's why in some cases you launched a tool that legally helps them, the Reporter's Shield. This is a program that helps defend journalism against legal harassment.
Yeah, these are really my heroes. These are the people that I do this work because of my love of local reporters in countries all over the world who have just said, I'm going to do this. And as an American journalist, you don't have these problems in their countries. You know, when you're hated by the government has a lot of tools to use against you. You know, an example is our partners in Serbia. They look at the role of organized crime in government. The government of Serbia has actually organized crime members in the government. The Minister of Health is a former doctor who killed people in hospitals on behalf of organized crime when the murder didn't get done in the street. And then he would take bribes in the form of apartments to do this kind of work. So he would kill people in the hospitals for organized crime. And he's a former now, but he was the Minister of Health in Serbia. And so the reporters who report on this are really running afoul of the government. And the government has done things such as say that these journalists are affiliated with a particular organized crime gang. This is the government calling these journalists part of an organized crime gang. That same organized crime gang was being killed in large numbers by a rival organized crime gang. So essentially the government was inviting another organized crime gang to kill these journalists. They actually have more lawsuits against their organization than they have journalists in the organization. And they're all from people who are close to the president. So they're really being harassed on a level that a journalist would never dream of. They're followed in the streets by state intelligence agents. So this is a really incredibly difficult job, but they continue to do it on a day in and day out basis. Any other normal human being would say, I'm going to quit. This is just not worth it. Mm. But if they didn't do the work they do, then nobody would know what's going on with that government. And so, we've seen journalists continue to do this work for so many years that it essentially becomes more profitable for a government or for a crime group to kill the journalist than to let them continue to do the work. And we saw that with a partner organization in Slovakia, whose journalist who was working with us at the time was murdered on another case. And that's what the film is going to be about at Stanford tomorrow. But as you look at actually what happened, we go through the incredible detail of what happened to this journalist and who was involved, in the government in this murder. And it's really quite frightening. And so we operate a, witness protection program for journalists. They do a story and then they have to disappear for a few months. And, this is a constant problem that we're doing and a bigger problem every single time. And so what we try to do is we try to create an environment where these journalists can do this work. And it's not only, you know, the threats, it's, you know, all our partner journalists in Russia had to leave. They lost their state pension. They lost, you know, sometimes cars or resources, or, you know, obviously they disconnected with friends and family. And it's a prison sentence if you help them in Russia. If you help OCCRP in Russia, you get a 5-year prison sentence. So these are really aggressive moves, and we try to create an environment where these reporters can continue to do the work. So we have a pension program that we've set up, or in the process of setting up for journalists. We created essentially an insurance company that can defend these people in the case of lawsuits against them. We have 64 lawsuits against the OCCRP network right now. And so that's more than one for every single organization. And many of them have a dozen or more lawsuits against them. And so we try to create a space where they can continue doing the work. And that's really one of the important goals of OCCRP. We want to continue to have a global network because it's those local journalists who really know what's going on. They're the ones that, you know, it was our Ukrainian journalists who help explain how Rudy Giuliani was dealing with, you know, organized crime figures in Ukraine when he was there. And that ended up being in the whistleblower complaint that led to the impeachment. Those kind of things really required a local journalist who knew that local businessman, who knew exactly what they were involved in. And that's the beauty of the network. But it's incredibly difficult to continue supporting everybody because of the difficulties that they face.
Drew, I want to make sure I heard that right. So if Russian journalists work with the OCCRP, they will get 5 years in prison?
Yes, we've been labeled an organization that is against the Russian state by the Russian state. You know, this is largely because of our reporting on Mr. Putin and the people close to him and his oligarchs. But we're an undesirable organization in Russia, and as an undesirable organization, we would, if you helped us in any way, you would be sentenced to 5 years in prison.
So what can you give us a sense of what Russian journalists have done? You said many of them had to leave the country.
Yes. So our partner organizations have all left. You cannot do journalism in Russia right now. We still have sources and we have places that we can get information in Russia, but they continue to report on Russia from Europe. And we had to move them all out very quickly. Sometimes we had to move family members. We had to get visas. You know, Russians were not exactly welcomed in many of the countries in Europe at that time. And so it's been a very difficult challenge, to do this, but you know, it's imperative to continue these reporters working, because if they all leave the business, then the world is not only, not better off, it's not safer.
Hmm. Last March, you all published the Russian Asset Tracker, and you report, though average Russians have seen their income stagnate in recent years, the country's wealthiest fly around the world in executive jets, lounge in Mediterranean mansions, and cruise the seas in some of the world's biggest yachts. Their children cavort in exclusive nightclubs and receive prestigious educations at the world's top universities. So you decided to follow the money trail, tracking down as many assets as possible and compiling them in a database for the public to see and use. And this is extensive. I mean, there are so many stories as part of this investigation. Sanctioning an oligarch is not easy. Why the money trail of Alisher Usmanov, one of Russia's wealthiest men, is difficult to follow. You've got another one, assets worth millions in the U.S. and Europe belong to the Voroyabiev family, Moscow political clan with close ties to defense minister Shoigu. I mean, there are at least 10 pieces in here. So, Drew, what is the fallout just from this package? Because this is just one of many packages that focuses on Russian wealth.
Yes, yeah, so, you know, sadly, we win awards and nothing happens. You know, the problem is that the oligarchs have help of, you know, lawyers in all these places, and the lawyers have figured out how sanctions work, and they make sure that everything is owned less than 51%, you know, by the oligarch themselves, and then they set up straw parties. You know, sometimes it's lawyers at the law firm. Sometimes it's, you know, individuals whose identity and existence can't even be traced. And you know, they basically have a lot of help by this kind of enabling industry to move funds around, move assets around. And so a lot of the assets, you know, even the large yachts have been seized, but they've not been sold or taken away from these people permanently. And in fact, there's lawsuits going on all over the world by these same oligarchs trying to get these funds released. And in many cases, they're going to be quite successful. So, you know, law enforcement and, you know, governments will come out and say, look, we seized all these assets. But if you track it down, most of the assets are not seized. And ultimately, unfortunately, a large percentage of them will go back into the hands of these same oligarchs who essentially stole it from the people of Russia, as, you know, the cost of, you know, a living goes up and the standard of living goes down in Russia. You know, it's we think the United States is, you know, you know, economically, segmented, it's really much worse in Russia. People barely have electricity and clean living standards and, you know, livable houses in many rural parts of Russia. And yet, these people are doing quite well, and their children are getting jobs at big Western banks and other places, you know, after degrees at Harvard and Yale. It's really unfair, and it's continuing to be unfair, unfortunately.
Do you know, Drew, before we go to break, have any Russian journalists been jailed because they're working with the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project?
None, because we basically moved everybody out, and everything beyond that is done very carefully.
So they actually had to leave their homes. I mean, we heard stories about this when Russia started bombing Ukraine, and it's just devastating. Drew Sullivan is co-founder and publisher of the OCCRP. Paul Radu is co-founder of the OCCRP, the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project. By developing and equipping a global network of investigative journalists and publishing their stories, the project exposes crime and corruption around the globe so the public can hold power to account. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, social scientist Sydney Calkin will discuss her new book, Abortion Pills Go Global, Reproductive Freedom Across Borders. She examines how the global flow of these pills is changing the politics of abortion in countries with restrictive abortion laws, including here in the United States. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email yourcall@kalw.org. And if you'd like to join today's conversation, we're speaking with Paul Radu and Drew Sullivan, co-founders of the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project. They work with a network of more than 55 nonprofit media centers around the world. They support journalists and publish their stories, exposing crime and corruption so the public can hold power to account. If you have any questions or comments about their work, about how journalists go about doing this, if you're familiar with their work, we've done several shows about their work, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Paul and Drew will be speaking about how to get dirty and dark money out of democracy tonight at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco at 6 p.m. Tomorrow, they'll be in discussion following a screening of The Killing of a Journalist. That event starts at noon in Stanford University's Encina Hall. You can find information at yourcallradio.org. So if you look at some of your recent investigations, I mean, even the headlines are head spinning in terms of how you all followed the money. Spain's La Liga Soccer League received Iranian money through shell company set up with purchased Dominican passport. Another one, fall of a Fijian trafficker exposes previous government's blind eye to meth. You've got information about a dozen people buying Dominica passports before going on the run over crimes back home. I mean, the list is so long. New sanctions on Lebanon's former central bank governor likely bring frozen assets to at least $20 million, according to documents. Sierra Leone's fishermen pay the price for government inaction on illegal industrial trawlers. Paul, there are just so many reports that you're all doing. And I mean, it's incredible when you look at the layers of involvement here in terms of the money that's passing hands. Would you like to talk about just a couple of these investigations? Which one really, I'm sure they all stand out for you, but which one do you think people really need to know about that might not be getting enough attention?
So, first of all, I should say that all these investigations, although they seem as being separate pieces, they're part of the same system. It's an investigative strategy, investigative system that we developed at OCCRP, where we put together investigative technology together with these Centers for Investigative Reporting, with these amazing reporters all over the world, and they're able to tackle organized crime, to investigate organized crime, from many entry points. So You basically, what we did at OCCRP was to reverse engineer how crime and corruption works. And this is why you're seeing all this array of stories, all this diversity of stories from all over the world. And this is our key point, our strength, that we can deploy these investigative systems from the South Pacific all the way to Asia, to the US, to all over the world, to expose as much crime and corruption as possible. Now, when you look at stories, I mean, I'm proud of every of our stories. But you mentioned earlier our Russian asset tracker project, and I want to say that this was very long term work. It's 15 years in the making. Mm-hmm. We were exposing Russians, you know, oligarchs and kleptocrats and Russian organized crime, you know, doing their investments, doing their biddings all over the world and affecting democracies and corrupting politicians. And, you know, the problem is that the world was not paying attention. The world was not paying enough attention. So last year, in the context of the war in Ukraine, you know, everybody started looking into this and started sanctioning Russian oligarchs left and right. It was a bit late. You know, we've exposed them, you know, for so many years, and now we created a package and we put everything in one place, and that was a huge hit. But, you know, people should be paying a bit more attention to this type of stories. Stories coming from all over the world showing how kleptocrats are building their criminal empires, their criminal structures that affect everybody, you know, not just in the countries where they are stealing the money from, but also very, very importantly, in the countries where they deposit, where they invest this money. So in terms of stories that particular attention should be paid to is really the role of enablers, the role of the enablers in the West, in the US, in Europe, in Australia, enablers who are assisting criminals setting up these structures to loot large scale. And also, I mean, on the investment side, I mean, a country like the US is a huge investment hub for these type of people. And this is something, you know, we keep on investigating, and we had partnerships with US media to investigate some of these issues. And it's all connected. You know, if you look at the looting that takes place in Africa, in many of those very poor countries, or in Brazil, where the environment is destroyed, and you almost always find a US connection. And I think that's where people need to be paying a little bit more attention, and where the US media should connect more with us, with OCCRP.
To your point, you're reminding me of something that we learned when we focused on the Pandora Papers. Again, this contains details on over 200 trusts set up in the United States in recent years. In dozens of cases, clients have abandoned more traditional havens, such as the British Virgin Islands and the Bahamas, in favor of the U.S. And we learned for the very first time that the most popular destination has been South Dakota, where the past decade has seen the value of assets held in trusts reach more than $360 billion. State laws in South Dakota allow for the establishment of secret trusts, which do not have to pay a cent of tax to the state for any earnings. So this was incredible to learn about, Paul. After this came out, it got a lot of attention. But I mean, there are South Dakota politicians that are speaking to the national media. I'm not hearing questions about what has happened as a result of these investigations.
The case of South Dakota is quite interesting, because it wasn't on the radar of investigative reporters or law enforcement. You know, and this is why business was flourishing there. And I think this also speaks to the lack of local reporting power in some of the U.S. states, where really the media, the local media, was decimated. We're actually here to help with this type of issues, because we can connect the dots internationally, and we can help say, like, well, you know, we're seeing in our work that there are many South Dakota trusts, you know, that are used for crime and corruption in various countries of the world. And we noticed the same some years ago with Delaware. Delaware was the South Dakota of, you know, about 10 years ago, where it was used on large scale organized crime operations and corruption. So again, this is an issue you know, that has to do with the cooperation, the cooperation across borders. You cannot see locally some of these things. You got to have the international dimension to see how your geography is used, is a structural part of these large-scale crimes that happen worldwide.
Hmm. Drew, what would you add specifically around what you are learning and what you're exposing about the West being a major enabler of this global crime and corruption, especially what's going on here in the United States that people might not know about?
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is what South Dakota did is typical. You also have problems in Utah and Wyoming and Nevada, you know, low population states with not large budgets. And this is the enabling industry helping out their international clients. And what they do is they go to a place like, you know, South Dakota, and they say, hey, you'll make a lot of money if you, you know, allow us to set up a bunch of blind trusts, and we'll bring large amounts of money in and you'll benefit from it. And of course, that's true. But what they're also benefiting is organized crime and corruption. And consequently, you know, we have to just basically stop that. We can't allow these, you know, free trade zones and other things that allow, you know, the opaque structures to exist, which fundamentally just benefit organized crime and corruption. The only reason you're hiding those monies is because of, you know, corruption. You know, people who have large family wealth, they set up a foundation, or they have trusts, or they have other things. They don't need these you know, types of things. And so that's a real problem. But you also, you know, in New York, you know, you have massive amounts of money laundering, and it creates a system where, you know, when you've got to launder money, or when you've got to place money that you've stolen or that you've made from drug trafficking, you know, it's easy to get rid of a couple million dollars. It's very difficult to get rid of $1 billion. And that's what a lot of these people have to do. And so they don't want a $2 million apartment in New York. They want a $200 million apartment in New York. They want to be able to put large amounts of money into something. And so you have whole buildings being built in New York and in London that are just really, holdings for criminal money. And so it just gets parked into these buildings. And what it does is it raises the cost of living in New York, because there's less affordable apartments and there's these big expensive ones. And so, you know, working class people and even, white collar, business people have to move out of New York because they just can't afford to live there. There are whole neighborhoods in London that are completely empty, because they're all owned by offshore people. There's buildings on Hyde Park and other things that are owned almost exclusively by offshore companies. And this is all the kind of the laundering of the assets into the West. And where people don't see it are things like farmland. A tremendous amount of farmland in the United States is owned by, you know, drug cartels and from Mexico. And we just don't know. They've been hidden behind, you know, South Dakota trusts. So we don't know that that's the Sinaloa drug cartel that, you know, owns, you know, half of our, you know, county. And so this is the problem is, and this, you know, these are not good stewards of land. These are not good stewards of property. And they don't care what damage they cause. So we have the situation where huge amounts of money is flowing to the West, probably the most since colonialism. And it's just making money incredibly cheap here. But it's making money very expensive in other countries. And so consequently, it's become so cheap, we have inflation. So these matters are really skewing the fundamental economics of the world. And that's the problem. And the United States is where a lot of these things, and a lot of people have become quite wealthy and quite well known being in this kind of criminal, we call it the criminal services industry, the enablers. And so President Anastasiades of Cyprus is a guy who basically, you know, set up a lot of, companies in Cyprus for Russians, you know, to illegally steal money from Russia. And, you know, former President Trump built high-end apartments for organized crime figures. You know, he's part of the enabling industry. He helped hide their ownership, you know, through New York LLCs and other things. And so consequently, this industry itself is becoming politically and financially powerful from helping organized crime people. And that's a problem.
And as you say, this is fueling inequality around the globe. And as you know, Oxfam puts out an inequality report every year. I mean, the numbers are just staggering. Here's just one. Yes. 252 men have more wealth than all 1 billion women and girls in Africa, Latin America, and the Caribbean combined. I mean, that is just one of so many statistics.
And those kind of disparities, you know, there's some fundamental things that are going on in our society and technology that are exacerbating these. But the problem is this money is profoundly plutocratic, and it is seeking to change laws to make things, you know, more friendly to their money and towards, you know, systems that keep this money in single families. And, you know, we saw in Luxembourg, or it was Liechtenstein, where a person filed a suit against the ultimate beneficial owner system in the country as Luxembourg, which allowed, you know, you to find the ultimate beneficial owner. And it turns out this was a businessman there who exclusively dealt with Russians and who made a lot of money off Russians. And so he was acting in behalf of his clients, you know, to change the law that ultimately benefited them more. And that's what's going on in so many places. And that's exacerbating the wealth split.
Today, we're speaking with Drew Sullivan and Paul Radu, co-founders of the OCCRP, the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project. Let's hear from Peter in Florida. Hi, Peter. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. I'm surprised you took my call. But when you started talking about South Dakota, I said, that's domestic. I can squeeze in here. What I'm concerned is, because I thought about this, it's like, You assume there are regulation and people supervising and there's someone watching over that. That could never happen. But sometimes those experts, people are experts on bulls and they see nothing wrong with a bull in the China shop, is what I'm saying. Is it's like, what are you an expert on? Are you an expert on China shops or bulls? Point is, I guess, because I'm thinking about the Americans with Disabilities Act, and there are panels of experts, but it's like, who gets to say they're experts? It's been a disaster for blind people, but the people sitting there, they don't see any problems. It's like, I'm going to use the analogy again. It's like, they're bulls. They're not aware of the China shop and the value of the China, and they're destroying perfectly good things, things that are invaluable to blind people.
Peter, we're almost out of time. Do you have a specific question for Paul and Drew?
Well, because you're talking about keeping an eye on these corrupt organizations, but I'm saying corruption is happening domestically also, and sometimes it's a matter of the definition of words and assuming that there's oversight, but then you got to keep going up the chain. Well, who has oversight over that oversight?
Well, thank you for calling. And that speaks to what they're talking about. I mean, earlier, Paul said that there's 10,000 investigative journalists around the globe. And Drew, you know, here in the United States, we're constantly seeing layoffs from major media outlets. The media, in many cases, there's so much attention on Trump. I mean, some of it is justified, but definitely not all of it. I mean, we're really in a crisis here in the United States when it comes to journalism, especially investigative journalism.
Yeah, it's you know, the model doesn't work anymore, unfortunately, and we're seeing consolidation in large news organizations, but the middle ground is disappearing. The news and across, you know, in areas where you would identify where large amounts of, you know, farmland is being bought by offshore companies, that story isn't getting out, and that's really a problem. And it's going to be, unfortunately, it's going to get worse before it gets better. I think there's a lot of organizations in the United States that are trying to do something about it and to invest in media. But, you know, Russia spends billions of dollars in media. And of course, it's media is largely propagandist, but, you know, Russia is a very cheap country and Putin is a very cheap man. But he sees media as something that really has to be invested in heavily, and he's done that. And the Russian media is quite sophisticated. And in the West, we've really relied on this financial model, and that model has failed us. And we really haven't figured out, you know, how to fix it. So we have nonprofit media, but they're small and they're really, you know, they're scraping to survive. And, you know, we don't have a system that supports media. And in a democracy, you know, you don't need media in Russia. You know, it's just propaganda. You do need media in a place like the United States. And there's been a movement against media. And part of that is propaganda. It's designed, you know, don't listen to the media, you know, listen to us. You know, that's propaganda. You know, the media is still independent in the United States. It doesn't always do a great job on some things, and there are issues it's terrible at, but it's fundamentally giving you the truth that it believes, you know, to be true. But we need a much bigger investment in media. And unfortunately, it's not getting there. There's a number of good people who've supported us and continue to support us and other media organizations. And we hope to grow that. You know, we have an accomplice program on our website where people can join, and get access to information and meetings with us, you know, as a way of kind of, you know, improving people's ability to get the information and get questions answered directly. There's a lot of great publications around the United States, you know, Texas Tribune, The Observer, all these organizations doing good work, but we need to scale up by a factor of 100. In order to really explain to the people. And we're working on trying to do that in our part, but it's going to be an almost generational fight.
We have a question from a listener, Kim, who says, what can average people do about all of this? It just seems so big. Paul, you say that if people have the information about these crime networks, they can change the system. And if you look at what has happened since 2009, the stories you've all published exposing corruption have contributed to 620 indictments, arrests, and sentences, 130 high-level resignations and sackings, 700 government actions. So change is possible if people have the information.
Change is possible, and citizens need to be part of this change. Citizens, you know, I'm a big believer in that everybody can be an investigator. Every citizen can be an investigator. It's not the you know, this popular journalism or citizen journalism that was promoted some decade ago. It's really about citizen investigative reporting, where citizens are equipped with the proper investigative tools, investigative strategies, and the security tools to make this type of work in a safe way. And that's what we're trying to do at OCCRP. That's where, you know, we're making available our technology, our thinking, the context around crime and corruption to everybody. And this, you know, this is, it's actually a space that's grown slowly. You know, we're partnering up with U.S. media in order to ensure that the U.S. media has access to the international context. But we do need, at the end of this, you know, we do need to have OCCRP and similar networks. You know, in the U.S. here you have ProPublica, which is doing amazing work locally. We will partner up with this type of networks to bring more content, you know, for the people to see how organized crime operates, how organized crime affects their lives. But we do need interested citizens to be to blow the whistle on certain things, to give us the information, to give their there are other contexts, you know, in what's left of the papers in various places in the U.S. You know, we need them to be in touch with journalists and to trust those journalists, because these are people who dedicated their life to fighting corruption and organized crime.
Well, and I just want to mention, because this is a very important investigation, I read it last night. The OCCRP worked with the Chicago Sun-Times and Chicago's local public radio station, WBEZ, to expose ties between at least 27 current and former Chicago police officers whose names appeared in leaked rosters for the Oath Keepers, the extremist group that played a central role in the January 6th insurrection. The investigation found allegations of excessive force, improper searches, and racist comments on the job. At least 9 of these police officials remain in the police force. So this is just one of so many important investigations that the OCCRP works on and supports. And I hope you can take the time to read about this. Some of the stories are just devastating. You can find it at yourcallradio.org. But as they say, shining the light does result in change. Paul Radu and Drew Sullivan are co-founders of the OCCRP, the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project. They will be talking tonight at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco at 6 p.m. about how to get dirty and dark money out of democracy. Tomorrow, they will be in discussion following a screening of the documentary, The Killing of a Journalist. That event starts at noon at Stanford University's Encina Hall. You can find information at yourcallradio.org. Drew and Paul, thank you so much for your work and all of the OCCRP journalists and media outlets. And thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Rose.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks to Malihe Razazan and Sarah Lee Sterling for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering our show. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.